Hi, everybody. My name's Carla Rowell, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm just really thrilled to be here. I want to thank Bob for that long-term notice that I got last night. You know, your life can change on a dime, and if you're up to it, you know, you can roll with it. It's a lot of fun to be here. I've been thrilled. I was on my way to my grandson's birthday party last night. He just turned 11, and I could hardly contain myself, really. I was singing Happy Birthday, a couple of bars of Happy Birthday, and then maybe Southwest has a good flight, and, you know, back and forth, and trying real hard to stay in the room, you know, and I made it, and I want to thank Rick and Matt and Todd for hooking up with me at the airport and hosting me and driving me over here, I know I have a lot of friends in this audience, friends I've known for some time and friends I haven't met yet, and my sponsors here, so I'm sure there'll be an inventory next week. I want to thank you, Bob, and the committee. And what I love about this conference is that I know that there may not be too many newcomers, but I know that we're all on the same page. We're here celebrating and sharing this design for living that we know works. We all have experience with it, and we had a spiritual awakening, and the awakening has to continue. We can't rest on our laurels, and we can't you know, I can't stay sober today on yesterday's sobriety, on yesterday's actions. And so we're all here, and there's a different kind of energy here. I know that most of you don't have to be convinced. We already know it works. And so I feel a little celebratory here. And to share this podium with some people that I've admired over the years and gotten so much from, I always hope that I can give as good as I get, because I've gotten a lot. I owe you a lot. My sobriety date, September 25th, 1987. And before that, I never did anything for 24 years in a row on purpose that was of any value. I want to tell you that. I love that this conference falls right before the holidays or right during the holiday season. You know, I know it's Bill Wilson's sobriety date. I think it's the 11th, but I'm not sure. But this weekend, he was getting well. And for the last time, he was, and boy, do you remember your last time? I remember I was 89 days sober, just coming up on 90 days sober, and I was at the office Christmas party, and we had gone to this restaurant, and I was feeling very sorry for myself, just filled with self-pity, and every day that obsession to drink hadn't left me. You know, it was every day I was getting up wondering, am I going to drink today? Am I not going to drink? Am I going to drink? It was just on me. And I'd go to meetings, and I'd hear people with 3 days say, yes, the obsession is lifted. And I, you know, it's just like, oh, good for you. I'm very happy for you. But I was tense, and I didn't, you know, I wanted to laugh, but I couldn't, and everything was just very serious. And so I'm at this office Christmas party, and everybody's drinking like regular drinkers. You know, they don't know how to do it. They sip and they leave it sitting, and the straws are falling out of the glasses, and I can only be there for just a little while, and then I know I can leave as soon as I just absolutely have to. But I had to make a showing, and I get there, and then we start playing this White Elephant Christmas party gift exchange, you know, where they set up a whole bunch of Christmas gifts, and everybody draws a number, and then you take one, and then the next person after you can steal yours, or they can take a new one. And so we get to the end, and I get this wonderful gift, and I get this great gift that I love, and I want to keep it, and someone keeps taking it away from me, and I think, okay, and then I get a better one, and I like that, and someone takes that away from me, and then I'm like, God, can I just not catch a break? Can I just not catch a break? And it's all about a White Elephant Christmas gift. You know, I could go to this dime store and buy something, but I'm all into this game, and I finally get to the end, and I get the gift that I get to keep. And I open it up, and it's a little black coffee cup, and it says, life's the bitch, and then you die. And I still have that cup, you know. But I got it. You know, for the first time, you know, just something in me started to relax just a little bit. And I wasn't even in a meeting, you know, but I carried you with me. And I'm just so, sobriety is different, I'll tell you. I'm glad they didn't promise me it was going to be comfortable, but they did promise me it would be worth it, and it has been. When I got here, it was very important for me to figure out why I'm an alcoholic. Why am I an alcoholic? People, when I got sober, were walking around with teddy bears, and there was all this, you know, the inner child thing coming on. And, I don't know if that's, there was just all this stuff mixed up in people bringing it into AA and everything. And I didn't know really what all the difference was until a little while. I had to ask a lot of questions. So why am I an alcoholic? Is it because my dark, dramatic, violent, perverted childhood, my family, if you had my family, you'd drink too. And then I stayed around long enough to find out that there are people who live charmed childhoods same thing happens to them when they pick up a drink of alcohol. They're allergic. They can't control the amount they take. And when they stop for an amount of time, they get that. They're either drinking or thinking about drinking. That's the quick way of saying it. They're either drinking or thinking about drinking. And that doesn't matter where we come from. Alcoholism just doesn't care. But it took me a while to learn that. There are two little simple sentences on page 44 in our book that says, if when you honestly want to, find that you can't quit entirely, or if when drinking you can't control, you have little control over the amount you take, you're probably alcoholic. It says it right there. And so if you are fairly new, if you're in your first year or two, and you still don't know what alcoholism is, because I sit and I hear alcoholic thinking, what's alcoholic thinking? Do you want more? Well, I know lots of people who want more and more and more stuff, but I wanted more alcohol. I wanted more alcohol. And when I heard you guys talking about alcoholism and drinking alcohol in here, I knew I was in the right place. I heard chapter 3 read, a portion of chapter 3 read at the beginning of a lot of the meetings where I went to, and I got it. I heard something in there that said that somebody understood the way that I drank, and that somebody had an answer. Somebody had a solution for the way that I drank. And I wasn't so sure that these 12 little thinly veiled sentences were going to have any effect on me in the face of what I'd become. You know, they just seem so weak. 12 little sentences, and it felt like I'd kind of heard them all before anyway. So my childhood didn't make me alcoholic. It gave me an inventory, though. And we have a solution for that. I was one of those kids. I was a new kid on the block a lot. My mother moved for the rent. She was a single mom, two kids at the time, and we moved around a lot. And the way I found my way inside, inside into whatever group I wanted to be in was to be the best and the most and the first and in charge. To this day, you know, if I'm not paying attention, I can be walking next to you on the sidewalk, and if you're walking a little ahead of me, I got to move faster. And, you know, I don't even know I'm doing it. You know, I just have to be the first and the most and in charge and on top. I was going to be the first woman to run a 4-minute mile and the first woman Major League Baseball player and the first woman president. God, I had to be the first, and by the time sixth grade was over, I was tired and I needed a drink, really, you know. Now, we talk about the spiritual malady. We talk about that sense of uneasiness, that restlessness, irritability, and discontent. And now, if you're not alcoholic, if alcohol doesn't affect you the way that it affects me, then that we could call that the human condition. But my human condition manifests in alcoholism. My human condition, I used to treat with alcohol. In fact, for me, alcohol sort of brought me to the power. I've always believed in God, so I felt like alcohol kind of cleared the way and brought me to the power. And then sooner or later, it became the power, and then it dumped me. Someone said they couldn't. They didn't really know why we tell these stories, but why do we continue to tell our stories? But somewhere in here, somebody in here may need to hear how my spiritual malady manifests. Somebody may have the same. Our circumstances come dressed up in different costumes. Got my first social resentment behind a game of spin the bottle. And I know they don't even play that game these days. They just get right down to business. Could I have a little glass of water? Terrific, thanks. So I was at my friend Leonard's house. Thank you. I was at my friend Leonard's house. It was right before seventh grade, right before you, during the summer, right before seventh grade. And I was at my friend Leonard's house, and we were playing spin the bottle and passing around a bottle of his dad's whiskey. And now these weren't the first drinks I ever took, but these were the ones that started to really mean something to me, where I started to make the connection that alcohol would do something for me that I couldn't do for myself. And so we spun the bottle, and the bottle landed on me, and I went off into the bedroom with one of the boys, and we were both doing the same thing as far as I could tell. But when we came back out of that bedroom, they called him a player and me a slut, and I did not think that was fair. And I still don't think it's fair if you want to know the truth, but every sponsor I've ever had has told me the fair is in Pomona, and it lasts 2 weeks. That's all you get, so much for fair. And you know, I just couldn't. I was one of those people. I still can be that I couldn't accept the things I couldn't change. You know, a lot of healthy people will have an idea, they'll run into the wall with it and turn left. They'll say, "Whoops, that didn't work," and turn left. And I will beat my head against the wall till it's bleeding and can't figure out why you won't move the wall. And just trying to work it and wrest satisfaction out of life. And I got my feelings hurt in junior high. I got a reputation I didn't understand, nor could I take responsibility for. And I do what I do. I fight for a while, and then I back away from my life. My pride kicks in, and I just back away. I started spending more time in the girls' room than I did in the classroom and hanging out with the other girls who were backing away from their lives. And after a while, I just had to go. I got up and I left. I left school. Any sign of talent or gifts that I may have had, I traded away very young for the effect that alcohol would produce. Once I found alcohol, I was willing to go to any lengths to drink the way that I needed to drink. And I started to leave home. And I could be found on the on-ramps of the 10 freeway going east or the 101 freeway going north, and I'd stick my little thumb out on that on-ramp, and I'd crawl in the car or the truck going wherever with whoever, and I'd be on my way to somewhere else, and I love that feeling. I love that feeling today, but it's just that I love going home, too, and I have a home to go to, which is a big plus. You know, living indoors is something to be said for that. But consequently, I was young. I was out there and too young, and I would get picked up a lot. And I started spending a little time in the Southern California hot spots like Indio Jail and Riverside Juvenile Hall and L.A. Central Juvenile Hall and like that. And they tried to send me home for a while with mom and dad and alternate like that. And we did that dance for a while. And after a while, the courts took over, and I became a ward of the courts. And when I was 14, I got a long ride from Santa Barbara all the way to San Francisco with a friend, and they dropped us right off in the middle of a place called North Beach in the San Francisco area. And a couple of guys offered my friend and I money for sex out there. They propositioned us, and we said yes, and we did the next indicated thing, and boom, a whole new career path opened up for us. And I started living a day at a time in a way I've not had to live in a very, very long time. I was admitted to a mental hospital by a court-appointed psychiatrist, just there for 2 weeks observation. I ended up being there for a year. I sort of made myself at home and moved on in. They were not talking to me a lot about alcoholism. They were talking to me about disorders. I was a very disordered-looking child, alternately violent and withdrawn, and living with a level of frustration deep down in my gut that I didn't know how to talk about what was going on. I didn't know. I didn't trust you. I had to come to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I heard someone describe it as being like a scream without a mouth. And I so got that when I got here. I heard that. But back then, they were treating me with daily nutritional supplements, Thorazine, Melaril, Valium, Dalmane Sleepers. I suppose they were concerned I wouldn't sleep. I would be. I became intimately familiar with five-point restraints. And that's what I looked like at 15 years old. You know, I was. This was not a treatment center. It was a mental hospital. So there were some kids in there with some pretty serious diseases. There was real schizophrenia and real manic depression, some real serious stuff. And I looked just like them. And the only reason I know all these years later that I'm an alcoholic is because I was finally desperate and out of ideas enough to pick up your tools and use them. That's the only way I know. When I use the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous in my life, I get better. But I heard Father Tom say a few weeks ago that you got to be pretty desperate to find us interesting here. You know, a lot of people don't want to stay and do what we have to do. And it's sad to watch them walk away. So I've got these roommates. I'm And if you don't want to go crazy in the nut house, you got to get busy. And one of my favorite ways to be busy was boys. I've already told you that. I loved all the boys. You know, but my favorites were those sexy smoldering types. You know the kind. They just sit back there and simmer. You know what I mean? I know we have some in here tonight because I can see the smoke curling up. Yeah. Over there. And, you know, you never knew when they were going to blow. You just never really knew. And I found that very exciting back then. And today I know that feeling is fear. So I stay away. But I didn't know back then. And, well, like, for example, my first boyfriend, he got hauled off to YA for throwing a chair through the window. That's what he did. He blew and he threw a chair through the window. And my next boyfriend, he blew and he threw a nurse through the window. So that was progressive, too. And usually they're hiding out from some junior prison sentence, like from California Youth Authority or something, because they're underage. And when they blow, they get hauled away. And back then, inside, we used to play those sentimental jailhouse songs, you know, like, when will I see you again? And, oh, you know, press our little faces up against the bay window and long for what we couldn't have. Oh, there we go. And one afternoon, I was sitting outside on the smoke break bench. I was watching my boyfriend, Terry, being cuffed and escorted off by security. He's the one who threw the chair through the window, and he's gone. He's going. And so I'm watching this all happen, and I'm smoking my tragic cigarettes now and channeling Greta Garbo. And I just... I can't believe this is happening, really. And so I'm watching, and he's gone, really. And just inside the girls' unit over here, I can hear Diana Ross singing at top decibel, "Touch me in the morning, then just walk away." No, I don't know. Maybe none of you ever thought you should have a soundtrack to your life, but I did. I was brokenhearted and blue before I ever had a real date. And it took me a long time to learn that, you know. I had to come to Alcoholics Anonymous to see how I was looking at my life. I was always looking out there for what I thought was going to fix me. And the trouble was, I was always about half a bubble off what it was I thought I was looking at anyway, you know. I'd mistake arrogance for confidence. I'd mistake sex for love. I'd mistake brute strength for strength of character. And I'd get it up in my hot little hands and it'd turn to dust. It turned to nothing. It'd blow up in my face because it wasn't it. It wasn't real. I had to come here to find that it's when I give of myself, the constant thought of others and how I may help meet their needs. That's what makes the gaping hole in my soul get smaller. Never going to come from out there. But I had to take a long walk to get there. And, you know, I went from the girls' unit to the co-ed unit to Ward D in that hospital after a year. And by that time I was sitting on Ward D was really just the unit where they put the patients they didn't know what to do with anymore. They were just sort of, you know, hands up. And by that time, I would hang out in the day room. I was queen of the day room, a vision for you. I had casts on both my arms up to my shoulders because I've been cutting, because that's a whole different way to change my reality. And I was no longer bathing or getting dressed because you don't have to do that to date in the nut house. And I just sit on the day room couch and smoke my cigarettes. And I met, you know, the man I fell in love with. He was admitted on a 17-day, well, you know, he was going to kick heroin in 17 days. And he was admitted early one morning. And, it took me a long time to realize there might have been something wrong with him, too. Because he came in and he saw this sitting across the day room. And he said, "Her, I got to have her." I always think it's just me. And so I ended up going over the wall with him. For the last time, as I understand it, I heard from a little bird sometime later that they saw my little foot going up over the chimney and they said, "No, give her a minute." And and he and I, it lasted about 2.5 weeks. You know, I was 16, he was 22, I was coming off Thorazine, and he introduced me to cocaine, and I think it was just too much of a contrast for him. But oddly enough, my probation officer knew exactly where to find me, and it hurt my feelings to realize a little while later that he'd called her, you know, "Come get her, she's right here, please." And And my adolescent life went just like that. I was back in lockup and waiting for placement, one after another, into a rehab. And they were all just fine places. They all tried real hard, but I wasn't going to be honest with them. And besides that, with all the trouble that it caused, and I had found my way out of that mental hospital several times. When I was ready for a party, I'd just go. I'd go under the gate or over the fence or however you have to get out, but you're going to get out. I got out, and I'd be out for a week or two, and then I'd party, and I'd come back in the front door because that's where I live. So even with all the insanity for me was even that though I even with all the trouble that alcohol caused me, I was still right back out doing the very thing. It was still my best friend. It was still, I couldn't see it. And even if I could, even if I ever had an inkling, I wasn't ready. I just wasn't ready or willing to give that up because the window of relief was still this big, because alcohol still solved it this much. I ended up in a girls' home at the end of all of that, and it was kind of like a halfway house where they're trying to teach you how to grocery shop and cook and do all those kind of things. And I was going to a continuation high school, and the teacher graduated me because she just felt sorry for me because I was living in a girls' home and I'd work that, I met my roommate there in this girl's home, and she and I were on the same page. And now I want to tell you that I've always believed in God. I've always had some idea. Even when, as a little child, I felt the presence of God. I've always been a seeker. I was born into a Southern Baptist home, and that worked really well for my mom. There's just nothing wrong with any of these religions. It's just that I couldn't connect. Or at least I don't know if there is or not. I just couldn't connect, and it worked real well for my mom, I think. So I tried being a Catholic for a couple of weeks in fourth grade, but I was really attracted to the ceremony. I loved the little girls in white dresses and the missals and the rosaries and all of the. They say these long, long prayers called 7-hour novenas, and they seem to get what they want. They made a list and said the prayer, and they got it. And I thought, I want to try that, and that didn't seem to work. And I burned black candles for a couple of years and prayed to the other guy for a while, just trying to hedge my bets, really. I just want to be on the side that's winning, I don't care. And so I'm still searching. I'm trying to get some idea, even back then, I knew that there was something, And I started to develop this idea of a power greater than me, and it was sort of a combination of what I thought the 60s might have been like had I been out there. I was 12 in 1969, so they were over by the time I got out in the world. But they marched, they stood up, they said no, there was the Grateful Dead and Crosby, Stills, and Nash and Traffic, and they bled over into the 70s a little bit, but there was peace and love and flowers and free love and all of this really, really high playing stuff. That combined with the television series Kung Fu, some of you guys might remember. Very spiritual show. Sorry if you missed it. It's on cable now. Netflix. The star of the show was David Carradine, you remember, and he played a Shaolin priest, and that dude walked the Wild West in bare feet, right? He was tough, and people would mess with him for no good reason, except for that maybe he was Chinese, they'd come up and they'd say hateful things to him, and he, pearls of wisdom just rolled off his tongue, he'd stand there just so stately, and boom, and they would change, want to start doing good and stuff. Sometimes they'd come after him physically, whole groups of them, and he'd kick their ass. That was my favorite. So I've got this idea of strength and serenity going on in my head. And this is what I carried with me into the girls' home where I met my friend Jan. And she's like on the same page with me. And all of our friends said, man, those people that you're talking about, they all went to Oregon. You got to go to Oregon where God might be. And we went out the second story window and down the tree and into Randy's truck and off to Oregon, Eugene, Springfield area. They rented a little house and they let me come with them. And that's where I learned that when they talk about hoeing up there, they meant with a tool. It was just a whole different thing. Oh. And two things happened that I could certainly not see when it was happening. I could only see looking back. And one was, we couldn't always drink the way I needed to drink. And when we couldn't, when I didn't have any steps or fellowship or God of my understanding, and I had no booze, I was restless, irritable, and discontent, and very hard to get along with, edgy and itchy, you know, and uncomfortable in my skin, and kind of entitled and lazy and mean. And when I could drink the way I needed to drink, I was always overshooting the mark. You know, it was happening again, and still at 17 years old, I couldn't control the amount I was taking. My friends had asked me to leave, and I was asked to leave a lot. I ended up staying back with my father against his better judgment for a little while. And every morning I broke his heart, or every afternoon I broke his heart. We'd get up in the morning, and he'd take off for work, and I'd take off for his den, and I'd go sit in his den, and I'd drink from his liquor cabinet. And he'd come home in the afternoon and see me sitting in the very spot where he'd left me that morning. And it just broke his heart every day. I'd see that look in his eye, and after a few months, he had asked me to leave, and I know that that was the hardest thing he ever had to do. It was just before my 18th birthday, and I know that it was, he told me later, and all I could think of walking out the door was that one of the counselors at the rehab had told me I was a great actress, and so I'm sure I misunderstood this, but I ended up on Hollywood Boulevard, and there's not a lot of auditioning going on out there, I can promise you that, and I was 18 years old, start my days off with a pint of pop-off vodka, and I would go wherever the day took me, and some days it was a party, and some days it was just surviving, and there was not a lot of hope about it getting any different. And to this day, I love driving through Hollywood. I love driving past that same bus stop on Sunset Boulevard near Poinsettia Avenue, and I get to see a whole new generation of the same girls sitting out there with very little hope about it getting any different. And I say a prayer of gratitude for myself and a prayer of hope for her that maybe someday she'll get to find what I found here in AA. If alcoholism is a problem. But it just seemed like there was more of the same, you know, just more of the same. And a few months into that, I met a man walking down Hollywood Boulevard, and I saw the light in his eyes, and I didn't realize it was orange sunshine, but we hit it off, and I moved in with him that night, and I didn't even know his last name, and 6 weeks later he's asking me to leave, and I still don't know his last name. But I like to bring him up because years later he was on my 8-step list. He was someone who came to mind very quickly and clearly that I owed him amends. He'd been nothing but kind to me, and I went through his life like that proverbial tornado, physically, spiritually, mentally, materially, in every way I could. And no good deed went unpunished when it came to him, and he had to ask me to leave, and I spent the last part of my first year of sobriety looking all over for him. I mean, I knew there are some people you just know, and you know what to do about it, and there's just no question. And I couldn't find him. And my sponsor finally said, you know, you got to leave that. You're going to have to leave that alone. You're spending an awful lot of time on something you have no control over. If you're supposed to find that guy, you'll find him in God's time, not yours. So just set it down for a while and work on the other stuff. And there are some things you can do to change your behavior for now anyway, in the meantime. I mean, like, try being a friend to a man in a vertical fashion. Why don't you start there? You know, and all these years later, I love it. You know, right up there with that feeling of being useful is that feeling of self-respect. And I can walk into any room, and I can look you in the eye, and I can look your wife in the eye, and I love that. You know, those women used to look at me with that angry look or that resentful look or that look of pity or disdain. They knew right why I was there. And so did the men. And I didn't like that. And I knew it. There's only so much you can drink that away. And I don't have that these days. Fast forward, and right before my 13th AA birthday, I had to go give a talk on the other side of town, and it was a hot Sunday afternoon, and I didn't feel like going, and thank God you guys have taught me it's not how I feel, it's what I do that matters. And I went out and I gave that talk, and, you know, showing up, if you're kind of new, you know, showing up, that it just, you know, getting from the bed to the coffee pot, from the coffee pot to the car, and the car to the job, and just showing up. I never know what's going to happen that way, and my head certainly isn't going to talk me into it. Just showing up. And I went out and I gave the talk, and of course I felt better. And when it was over, the receiving line came up, and this man stopped and he said, "Where were you in 1976? And it was a guy from Hollywood Boulevard standing in front of me with 8.5 years of sobriety, and I with almost 13. Only a very well-organized, loving God could have made that happen when I, in all my efforts to get that done, just couldn't make it happen. And I like to tell that story to this day because it just reminds me that God's timing is always perfect. In these times of uncertainty, especially with no work or little work, or you never know where it's coming from, and just in any case, I mean, in sickness, and I know that God has it well in hand again and still. So I got to make those direct amends to this guy, and he said, "Oh my God, Carla, that's long forgiven, long forgotten. I just can't believe you're still alive." and he's right. You know, if we're in this room tonight, we're the lucky ones right here, right here, right now. We've managed to slip through that window of grace one more time, one more midnight, sit together and recharge and regroup and see what we can go out there and pack into the stream of life. And I never could do that before. And I left Hollywood and I hooked up with another guy, and you know, I've still got that soundtrack playing in my head. I've got Bob Dylan and Jackson Browne singing some of the saddest songs you ever heard. And I sleep by the side of the road, and we're hitchhiking up and down the California coast. And he and I, we love the idea of peace and love. We just couldn't stop knocking the hell out of each other long enough to implement the principles fully of peace and love. And we pitched a tent in the mountains in southern Oregon and lived there till the rains came. And then we moved into a roofless cabin just north of Grants Pass and threw a plastic tarp over the top and called it a skylight until the baby came. Then we had this little girl, and I thought having this little girl was going to change the way I drank. And, you know, we all know that alcoholism doesn't care who you love. It doesn't matter. And it was supposed to be little girl and booze and everything else. And, of course, we know what happened. It was booze and little girl and everything else. And she got in the way of one of our fights when she was about 10 months old, and I had to take her up the road where the hope is, right? Hope is just up the road. And I took her up to Idaho where it had to be better. And I had three jobs up there, tending bar and cocktail waitressing, and it never occurred to me not to drink on the job. Why else would you have that job? And my little girl was one of those kids that you see in her T-shirt and underwear and yesterday's lunch down the front of it because her mom's not paying attention. And I couldn't bring home I was not making bad money. And even with that, even with making the money that I was making, I still couldn't bring home enough to pay rent for more than a week at a time. So we're living in the rent-by-the-week motels until, of course, Idaho's not working either. We're back down in L.A. I'm renting a room for my aunt in Covina. I've got a job in Hollywood tending bar again. And I take off for that bar and take off from that house in Covina, and I kiss my little girl goodbye, who was almost 4 years old at the time. And I take off, and I'd stop at the halfway point on my way out to work. And the halfway point was a bar in Arcadia called the First Cabin. It was about, it was about 40 miles to Hollywood. And I'd stop in there and I'd have my primer drinks, so shots of Cuervo Gold and Bud Backs to get me ready to go do my shift. And I did that every afternoon like clockwork, every afternoon. And I'd go out there then and pour drinks drink with everybody till the wee hours of the morning and crawl back home and start all over again. And one afternoon I kissed my girl goodbye and I stopped at that same bar in Arcadia and had those same shots of Gold and same Bud Backs. And to this day, I don't know what was different on that day from the day before except for 24 hours. Because I didn't hate that job in Hollywood and I didn't love my daughter any less on that day than I love her today. But I sat on that bar stool and I couldn't stop drinking. I couldn't suspend my drinking long enough to get up and go take care of business in either direction. So I sat on that bar stool and I lost them both in one fell swoop. The kid and the job were gone. And I stayed and I lived off the kindness of strangers there in that little area in Arcadia for about a month there. And I'd make the rounds there in the neighborhood. And then I'd end up back in the first cabin at night about midnight. And I'd hear the band playing and the chatter in my head would be rising. And the effects of the booze would be coming down. And I'd start to think about my daughter. And I knew that you could walk right up to me and tell me I could have her back if I just stopped drinking. And I knew that that wouldn't happen. I knew. I couldn't have told you in these words, but alcohol had become my absolute master, my absolute. And I knew she was better off where she was. And I thought maybe getting married might do it. I met a man in the next bar where I worked, and he would bring me food and stuff. And I thought, maybe this is it. Maybe if I make my life look like I think yours is, maybe if we get an apartment and move indoors and get out of this business. It's this business that's doing it. And he and I got married about the time we should have split up, and we moved into a little apartment, and, you know, that's just geography. We moved in there. We bought ourselves a big gun to protect ourselves from the night stalker, and the only people we ever turned that gun on was each other. I just tried to get to it first, you know, to kind of level the playing field a little bit, and it went like that. And my first exposure to AA was after one of our fights. We were at the bar where we drank, and we were fighting over whether or not I should get off the bar stool, and I lost that fight, and I ended up with some black eyes and broken ribs, and no one feeling sorry for me on that bar, just glad I was leaving. My husband had to pick me up and take me to the hospital, and I got fixed up there, And he brought me home, and he had to go to work. He had to leave town for work that weekend. And before he left, he set me up with a giant ice chest full of beer and a bottle of Beefeater gin chilling on top. And now I'm drinking gin because tequila had been making me so mean. I mean, you understand. And I started drinking and dialing the phone, and I don't know all who I called, but I know I felt like a battered woman, so I called a battered woman shelter, and I asked the woman who answered the phone to fix my life. And she asked me if I'd ever been to an AA meeting. And I don't know how she made that leap, but she did. And I found an AA meeting not far from where I lived. It was a perfectly wonderful AA meeting. It was there then. It's there still. And I just wasn't ready. I went there with everything but readiness. And you can't make me ready, and I can't make myself ready. That's an individual experience. And I walked in there, and two very kind women sat me down and gave me the newcomer packet, a cup of coffee, and a tissue. And I sat and I listened to a woman speaker that night. She talked for about 45, 50 minutes. And the only thing I heard her say that night was that somewhere during her drinking career, she switched to beer. So I did. Walked out of there thinking, AA says switch to beer. And after all, beer's not really drinking, is it? It's more like a breakfast food, I think, you know. And it allowed me to drink for another couple of years. It sort of gave me the illusion I was controlling my drinking, and it allowed me to get a little further into my day without falling on my face. I got the kid back for better or worse, and the marriage, and we got evicted from that apartment and ended up living in a little room in his ex-wife's backyard. None of us liked that very much, and so I got a little willpower together, and I got a job answering phones for the city, and it was a perfectly wonderful job. It was my first time into real society, and I'd go there every day, and some days I'd try to get there without taking those drinks, those morning drinks that stop the shakes, and when I could do that, drinking would be all I could think about. So I'm either drinking or thinking about drinking, and I went through another year of that kind of alcoholic torture. You know, I'm either drinking or thinking about drinking, just trying to get to work and trying to be normal, just trying to will myself into normalness. And this marriage and the family, everything blew up in our face about a year later, where the cops are in the driveway at this little apartment where we lived, and the neighbors are peeking out the window wondering, one more time, looking at us and wondering what's going on at Charlie and Carla's house one more time. The kid's now almost 10 years old, and she's standing over in the corner, and she's got that look of fear in her eyes. And I can't tell her it's going to be any different. Finally, the husband leaves, the cops leave, they take the gun, everybody's gone. It's me and the kid and the beer. And I can't stop drinking. I still can't stop drinking. I see my life falling down around me one more time, and I can't stop drinking. This can't be the answer. My first sponsor told me if I wanted to affect a conscious contact with a power greater than myself, that maybe I could start by counting the coincidences that happened in my life. And one of the first ones I could count was that I had moved in next door to a woman who had 5 years of sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. And she had seen and heard that whole thing go down. And a couple of days later, she brought me a big book and a 12-12. She knocked on my door, and she came in, and she sat on my couch, and she told me her story. And she was just a woman properly armed with the facts about herself. She sat down, and she talked about herself. And in her story, I heard me. In her story, I could tell that she used to drink like me. And over the last year, I'd seen with my own eyes that she wasn't drinking anymore. And what got my attention about that was it didn't seem to bother her that she wasn't drinking. And how do you do that? And so she was done, and she was leaving my apartment. She turned to me, and she asked me if I had, Carla, do you have trouble accepting life on life's terms? And I said, absolutely not. Life sucks, and I fully understand that. It's no problem. Latitude problem. And it was about a week and a half later. I just didn't go back and buy any more beer. And I spent that weekend there alone at home. The kid was somewhere, probably at her father's, and I shook, and I stayed sick, and alone, and into Monday and into Tuesday, and by Tuesday afternoon I was stark raving sober, and I went back to my neighbor and I asked her what to do, and she sent me up to a meeting in Sierra Madre, California, and I went up there, and she said, not that there'll be any question, but raise your hand and tell them that you're new. By that time I weighed 110 pounds. I had those sunken eyes and swollen cheeks, and my liver distended, and just I looked like a beach ball on stilts, really. And I felt like if you blew on me, I'd turn to dust. And I went up there, and I sat way back by the exit sign just in case. And in that meeting, I heard a lot of hope. And for whatever reason, the hope I heard came in the form of small talk. And people seem to care about each other. They're like, how are the kids? How's it? Do you have a sponsor yet? God, it's nice to see you again. You know, and I just wondered, could my life ever be normal again? It just seemed like they just had this simplicity, this sweet simplicity about what was going on in that room. And I just didn't know if I could have that. And at the end of that meeting, the secretary did something very nice for me. She came back to the back of the meeting where I sat, and she brought me that portion of chapter 11, A Vision for You, that we read at the end of a lot of meetings. And she asked me to read, and I said yes. I took it from her, and I said yes, and I surrendered a little bit to the actions that we take in this program, and in meetings anyway. And as I read, I came into the room just a little bit, just like I do all these years later. Whenever you ask me to do something, I say yes, and I come into the room just a little bit. Will you read? Will you lead? Will you go pick up that newcomer? Will you find somebody who looks more uncomfortable than you feel and help them find the coffee and the big books and a sponsor and get their phone numbers? And will you help them get acclimated? And from the very first day, I remember them telling me to go out there and try to do something for somebody and not get caught. Man, that took me a long time, you know, all day. Come back in and report. I got a sponsor right away, and I love this today, that my sponsor at the time, her story was nothing like mine. She drank on her couch. That's all she did, drank on her couch and never went anywhere. And the places I went weren't that glamorous, but I went places, you know. I was, you know, a little type A, and she was like 3 years younger than I am now. And I thought, what the hell else has she got to do? Her life is over. So I'm busier than I've ever been in my life, and selfish and self-centered and all about me. And she took me through the steps of this program, and I just started doing everything. I surrendered. I had to drink one more time after 89 days, and then I came in and I got to stay. I started making amends, and that obsession to drink started to leave me right about 9 months sober, and that's about the time I was making amends. And the first round of amends I made to my family were the most important. They were the biggest ones. I had consistently broken their hearts over year after year after year after year, and done some pretty hideous things and said some pretty hideous things, and so that began. And my family has required a lot of follow up, and I was glad to do it. To this day, there's not one member of my family who will stand in the doorway and say, no, please don't go to the meeting. You know, none of them do that. They just, we'll see you when you get back. Then other women started asking me to sponsor them. And I got to tell you that the only thing I like better than my fifth step is yours. Because in your eyes, I see redemption, and I see forgivability, and I see lovability, and I see growth where I can't always see it in myself. And I hope that you stay long enough to have this come full circle. You know, we say that you have to give it away to keep it. My friend Earl says we have to give it away to get it. Because there's something very special that goes on once we do that. When I see the light come on in someone else's eyes, and then I see them carrying the message, and I see them carrying the message, it's something I hope you don't miss. After a couple of years, I had you guys. I was going to 2 and 3 meetings a day. I just felt safe. You know, in between work, I was showing up everywhere I needed to be except at home. You know, and after a couple of years, I was busy being wonderful in Alcoholics Anonymous. My daughter was starting to come home, 12 years old, beat up and bloody at all hours of the night. She'd been jumped into a gang and starting to find a sense of family and camaraderie out in the street where I used to. I'm getting worried about her. I'm getting worried for her. And, you know, on page 19 in her book, it says, a more important demonstration of our principles happens in our homes, occupations, and affairs. And I believe that if we're only doing it in these rooms, we're only half doing it. And I had to learn. I had to start going to one meeting a day and go to work and go home and take care of that kid. And it took a while. I had to put her in a treatment center. At the time, there was this place where they were treating kids like her. It was for me to show up. It was for me to show up and do that work. You know, whether or not I was promised a relationship with her or not at the end, it was for me to do that. And she got out, and that's where you guys taught me that mountains are moved a spoonful at a time, to learn to live with life's unresolved problems. She got out after about 6 months, and after a few more months, she wanted to go live with her dad, and I had to back up and let her go do that. And, you know, I learned to face life in Alcoholics Anonymous, in sobriety. Our book promises that we'll learn how to match calamity with serenity. And while I'm not always that serene, you know, I've learned over the years, I have been able to match it without drinking, and that had to be okay in the beginning, that I wasn't going to do it perfectly, but I had to be willing to do it, and we had to be willing not to look bad in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I continued to work. I continued to get better jobs, and after somewhere along the line, I think I got a little, I don't think it was complacent, but you just get the idea that nothing bad's going to happen. Now I'm working these 12 golden steps and I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing, and life's going to be a parade now. And maybe not a parade, but something real, you know. Certainly not not having at 5 years of sobriety a man coming in through my kitchen window and taking a knife to my neck and tying me up with a phone cord and raping me and robbing me in the middle of the night. I certainly didn't expect that. After 5 years, everybody talked about 5 years back then. I don't know, maybe if you're class of 87, right around that time, they all said the magic 5 years. When you're 5 years, you're really sober. And so I guess I had some expectation. And instead, there's a man in my bed on me in the middle of the night. And I got to tell you that at 5 years of sobriety, I had a much bigger God than I got here with. And I had a God I could trust. When I got here, I told you all the disjointed ideas I had about some power greater than myself. And a lady named Susan said, why don't you just call him God and let him get as big as he needs to be in your life? Why don't you just start there? And like our book promises, no matter how limited my idea of a power greater than myself was, it was a place to start. And God met me where I was. And I got to tell you, too, that my sponsor's God, I hated. I just couldn't stand her God. He was mean and judgmental and just prejudice and all kinds of things. And she said, you don't have to have my God. And I'm really glad I didn't. And I'm glad I didn't make my sponsor my higher power either. I mean, she was my guide and the rooms were my higher power for a while. But had she been my God, I might have had to leave when she left Alcoholics Anonymous when I was a little over 2 years sober. And I didn't have to do that. AA was working for me just fine. Our book says, God, you know, are we willing to believe that God's everything or he's nothing? He either is or he isn't. And over the years, I've just started to believe that, that I'm just, if God is everything and I'm a part of that, and that works for me. I read the spiritual teachings that resonate with me are the ones that are based on the principles of love and service. Those are the ones that I get. So I've got this man on my back in the middle of my bed in the middle of the night, and I'm saying this prayer, and we finally, after a few hours, we get in a little tussle in the living room, and I can't get out my front door because the bolt lock is locked and it's stuck. But we ended up, I guess he got shook up enough to where he ended up going out the same window he came in. And it turned out that I knew him. I'd actually watched him get sober 30 days before I did. I watched him get his life, his wife, his kids and everything back. And then I watched him join the church and leave AA behind. And when he went out like that. And what I choose to learn from that is that while the big book tells us to be quick to see where religious people are right, this is where I learn the terms and conditions of my disease. This is where I learn that I'm not one of those people who can go home after a Sunday sermon and have a glass of wine. I learned that here. I come to AA, I remember who and what I am, and then I can go anywhere I want to and worship. I practice that 11th step. My sponsor told me I was going to have to forgive this guy, and I know she's right. I know we're people who can't handle even seemingly justifiable resentments. And I had to kind of shy away from the people, and I knew they meant well, but they were like, yeah, I want to kick his ass for you. And I knew, you know, thank you very much. You know, I had my friend, I love that Carl Morris is here tonight, because it was one of his sponsees who was a friend of mine who came over and stayed for a few weeks on my couch with his, 9mm. And he was going to handle things until we found this guy. And, you know, what did we know? I don't know. He was apparently he wasn't calling his sponsor. But it's a small world. So, I got to get rid of this resentment, but he scared me. The guy scared me. And the way that I knew how to react to that kind of fear at that level at the time was anger. Anger still meant, it still worked for me to some degree. It made me feel focused and like I had a momentum, and that if I didn't have that, if I didn't use that, I couldn't walk into my life and I couldn't function, and maybe you'd walk all over me. If I were to let go of this, I'll be the hole in the donut. I don't know what I'm supposed to look like on the other side of this, but I know it's got to go. And that seven-step prayer became my mantra. That's what I said, day in, day out, day in, day out. And I'm looking for the crack in crack of light. You know, I just I know I got to let it go. And there was a court trial, and as part of the defense, they had a lot of the guys I'd known years before get up and testify as to who I used to be, including my ex-husband. And that's the mark I left on him, was the fact that he was more inclined to testify on behalf of a rapist than he was for me. And he's never been interested in any of my amends, and that has to be okay now. So we had to get a character witness for me. And by that time, I was working at a big fancy financial firm downtown Los Angeles. And it's a place that years before, I never even would have walked in the front door. I never would have had any business being there. And now I'm working at a place where Henry Kissinger walks the halls. And I was glad to be there, you know. And so I get that. I get it. So the division head at this company offers to come and vouch for my character at 5 years of sobriety. And they told him all about who I was, or who I used to be. And he said, yeah, but she shows up early and she stays late, and she was where she said she was. And see, that's Alcoholics Anonymous speaking for itself. He didn't have to be coached. He just got up and told the truth as he'd experienced it through me. And then it was my turn to testify, and I got up and I sat in that witness stand, and I looked out at the defense table, and I could see that that's a place where I've sat before, and I could sit again. And it occurred to me that if I were to take a drink at that time, I could be sitting in his very seat. I could be sitting right where he was, maybe not for rape, but something equally as destructive. What started to occur to me was that what we were right at that time, he was spiritually sick like me, and that what we were two alcoholics sitting on opposite sides of the courtroom. And that crack of light came in under the doorway, you know, and I was just able to start to let go, to start to relinquish the fear. And most of the things that I've had to, that have been required of me was a letting go, not even acquiring right away, but the willingness to let go of an old idea or an old idea. And it took about 18 months for the fears and the nightmares and all the stuff attendant to something like that to finally go. But I knew it had to. I knew it had to go. I didn't want it coloring my present anymore. I know how that works. I know how resentment can color my present. And the detective who worked the case came to me and he said, I don't know who you were back then. I'm not even sure I want to know. But whatever it is you're doing now, you keep doing it because it seems to be working. And see, that's Alcoholics Anonymous speaking for itself. The guy got 20 years, he got sentenced to 20 years, and he did 17, and he's not been able to stay sober. I get a notice whenever he gets back out of prison, and I've had, six or seven of those notices now. He can't stay sober, he can't stay out of prison. And I know that it works in prison. I've been to some fine meetings inside prison. I've been to some very cohesive group, as fine a meeting on the inside as I've ever been on the outside, where these guys are using the steps and the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous to be useful to each other and to the people that they've harmed. And I've seen it with my own eyes. Now, I did not want to go into this prison the first time and tell them that I had testified against so many. I didn't know how that was going to play out, really. But I went in and I told the story, and they came to me afterward and they said, you're in the safest place you could possibly be, Carla. You know, we love you. And since then, I've been able to have, you know, a few talks and get to know some of the guys. And some of them are never getting out. And yet they found a way to be spiritually free on the inside of those walls. Not that they wouldn't trade places physically, I know. But they found a way to be as free as they can. But this guy, it's none of my business. He just hasn't used it. Alcoholics Anonymous works, and I get in my own way. You know, the alcohol is gone, and I'm the one. It's principles before personalities, and most of the time it's my personality that I have to get out of the way of. I have run the gamut. I've bankrupted myself. I've changed my home group about three different times. I've started over in Alcoholics Anonymous without drinking, and I think that's the best way to start over in Alcoholics Anonymous, if you ask me, is just, you know, start over. And maybe it's just continuing. You know, we're not perfect, and the longer I stay here, the more I know that I'm a human being, and that's probably the highest I'll ever get, I'm sure. If you see wings sprouting, you better let me know. But it works. You know, my father doesn't have to sit up nights anymore watching the news to make sure his daughter's name isn't on a list of the victims of the serial killers of the day. You know, he sleeps well and he knows why. When I was 5 years sober, he came to me and he told me that he'd been diagnosed with prostate cancer. And he asked me to be the one to walk through it with them. And I was the one that caused them all the trouble. I was the one that they thought they were going to lose right away. And now I'm the one that he's asking to walk through that with them. My daughter came back to live with me, and now I'm the grandmother of two beautiful boys, 11 and 16 years old. And I sat with those boys a couple of years ago and watched their mother graduate from Cal Poly Pomona with a bachelor's degree. And she wanted to be a probation officer. That apple ran screaming from the tree, you know what I mean? Now she's working on her master's. Now she's working on her master's degree. She wants to help families come back together, you know. And my mom was the hardest. About 2 years before I got sober, my baby sister committed suicide at the age of 17, and it took her all weekend to die. And while she lay on life support in a West Covina hospital, the family would be in the waiting room, and I'd go out to the van where the booze was, and I'd drink, and I'd come back in the waiting room, and I'd just rake my mother across the coals. It was her fault. She did it, and I just talked to her in a way a daughter should never talk to a mother, especially when her baby lay dying in the next room. And I don't know how you make amends for that, really, except that I started by calling her once a week and trying to find how I might add to her life instead of take for a change. And that required listening, just shut up and listen. And my mom had a lot of problems of her own, but when I quit judging and started trying to find out how I might be of service, our relationship changed, and she didn't seem so bad, you know, and we got pretty close over the years, and so close that about 10 years ago, my baby brother died of this disease. He was 6'10", 30 years old, 160 pounds when he lay on life support in a Spokane hospital, little pinholes in his heart from doing crank, and he wasn't going to stop drinking. Mercifully, when he died, I got to go up and be the kind of a daughter my mother needed while she buried yet a second child. And I don't know how you make amends. I don't know what kind of pain that is for a parent. But this time, because of Alcoholics Anonymous, I got to be part of the solution rather than part of the problem. And I was afraid that maybe I had left something undone. You know, my mom died a couple of years ago of end-stage liver disease. And I went to my stepfather when I went up to visit him, and I asked him. I said, "Did mom ever confide in you, and that she needed something from me I didn't give her, or that she anything like that?" And he said, "Absolutely not. You know, you gave your mom everything. She was so happy and so proud of you, and you can hardly call their house without having to listen to 20 minutes of how they love me and all that they think of me." And so I left that good. It felt like I had, but I needed to know. You know, my God is in the right now. My God is in the right now, and I know that there's a God because He answers questions I don't ask out loud. Nor do I always know that they need asking. I don't know about you, but from time to time in my sobriety, I can start to take things a little too seriously. You know. After I thought I got this, when I was 6 months or a year or 2 years sober, I thought I knew everything. You know, I thought I knew how I didn't want to be when I was 20 years sober. I didn't want to be like that, and I didn't want to be like that, you know, and work the steps or die. And just very intense, you know. And through the years, you know, that can kind of crawl up in you again, you know, that perfectionism. And perfectionism doesn't mean you're perfect. It just means that you're obsessed with the idea of becoming. So that can... I know it made me hard to be around, and my sponsees didn't want to call me. You know, they were like, "You call her." "No, you call her." "I don't want to call her. You call her." You know, and I knew they loved me, but they just didn't want to talk to me. You know, it was just that kind of... Now, the steps work wonders, but Bill Wilson also talked about getting good exercise, treating the whole body, you know, body, mind, and spirit. They all work together, and over the years, I've done things like worked at the gym, worked out, keep the body, pulls some of the static out of my head, and it gets that out of the way. I started rollerblading and meditating. You know, I like that, contemplative meditation, you know. You know, lift your foot. There's a curb. Don't argue with the curb. The curb is there, yes. And tried surfing for a little while. You know, that requires a little focus. The medium's always moving, and you up on the surfboard. My friend Lisa, now, she says that surfing is a lot like being in a domestically violent relationship without actually having to have a boyfriend. And I agree with that. I didn't spend a lot of time surfing. You know, you got to have a little fun in sobriety, too. You know, you got to do something. And so I left surfing. I thought, what's next? And so I walked right into an Arthur Murray dance studio. Had no idea. I just walked in. I took this complimentary rumba lesson. I didn't know how stiff and brittle I'd become, you know, about 17 years sober, 47 years old. And I walked in there, and so I'm with my teacher, and you got to get a wiggle on to do the rumba. You just do. I mean, some of you might know that. And right in the middle of my lesson, the teacher stops and he slaps his forehead. He says, "Oh, Carla, do not try to dance like a good girl. I don't think they will believe you anyway." So true story. He just came right out of his mouth. And in the ninth chapter of our book, it says that in God's hands, our dark past will become our dark past is our greatest possession. And my past has been woven into a huge tapestry that is my life. It's there for those who need to see it to see it. And yet I walk a free woman in the real world, awake and alive and looking you in the eye. And I love that. I couldn't have gotten that anywhere else. My God is in the now. And I discovered that by dancing. And I'll tell you, or not discovered, but rediscovered that by dancing. Howard Key always says, wherever you see God, mark that spot and go sit in that window again. And over the years, over 24 years, I found a lot of windows, you know, and I use them. And I discovered with dancing, with ballroom dancing, you know, the dresses and that whole thing. When I'm not worried about the step I'm about to take, and I'm not worried about not pissed off about the step I just took or how I messed that up, when I'm in the now and I allow myself to be led, I never know what pattern I'm executing till I'm done. And I get to experience the now, and right now is where the God is. And that's what I know. That's my experience. And the awakening continues. I get to stay sober and live a life that I could never imagine. I married the man of my dreams this year, and I didn't even know it. I was 21 years sober and 51 years old. So if you're new, there's hope. I'm so glad I didn't stand around tapping my foot, you know, waiting for him. You know, I had to learn a lot over the last 24 years with that. And I'm so glad I heard you say when I got here that if I come here for anything but sobriety, I'll probably leave as soon as I get it. And now maybe you have a different experience than that, but I'm glad I had that to focus on. So stuff is happening. I made a lot of big mistakes, but I met the man of my dreams, and this was a guy that I had known for years, Doug R., and he says hello to everybody that might ask, and he sends his love, and we sat next to each other in a workshop on Saturday morning for years, and we've known each other in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous for years, but we had to be planted at a conference in Arizona for us to start talking at the level that we started talking, and then we flew home on the same plane, and he asked me out to a play, and as he puts it, we've been playing ever since, and we remodeled the backyard and had a couple hundred of our favorite people come back and celebrate our wedding with us. Our friend Tim performed the ceremony, and our friends Lee and Jacqueline were there, and Lee was the best man, and you just never know where your life is going to take you, and it's okay. The more I loosen my grip, the more fun I have. And you guys taught me how to do that. You know, I'm no longer, well, every now and then I am. I've got my, you know, I can go there, but I've got the 10th step for that. You know, I've got a great sponsor. I still believe in sponsorship, but my idea about sponsorship has changed over the years. Anyway, I want to tell you that my friend Don Newcomb, the convict, not the baseball player, and I always feel the need to make that clear, but he came to me and he said, "I thought you were going to leave AA. I was really afraid you'd love that dancing thing so much that you'd just leave AA and go off and do that." And he said, "But I see now that what had to happen was that little girl who went to North Beach had to step aside so the lady who dances could come out." If you're new or if you've been around a while, find that window. Find that window again, or find a new window and mark that spot and go sit there again and find the God that's right here, right now. I'm so pleased to be here with you, and I hope I get to chat with a lot of you afterwards. Thanks again so much for having me.